Don't forget to tip your gondolier. It's time for another flat chat. As the latest issue of GP Racing hits the shelves in the UK, this is the first flat chat to be hosted on location in almost 3 years. I'm thinking Hungarian Grand Prix 2019, maybe. Everything you think was a year ago is actually 2 or 3 years ago. So maybe it was 5 years ago. Who knows? Anyway, here I am in Miami for the first Grand Prix to feature both a 12-seater gondola cable car system and a fake marina, and both of which have excited much attention. And let me usher in two guests into this virtual gondolier, neither of whom are actually here. Mark Gallagher, Boca Raton, Louisiana. What's all that about?
Yeah, no, I'm only down the road from you, mate. I'm about 40 minutes from where you're broadcasting from.
By private jet, I bet.
Down on the coast, and I'm in a hotel which has a real marina. And I did try to walk on the water last night, but it is real. So that wasn't very sensible. But I'm down on the coast here.
My geography failed me, isn't it? Boca Raton is in Florida. I was thinking of Baton Rouge.
No, you're thinking of Baton Rouge. No, Boca Raton is just down the road from Miami Gardens. Actually drove past the circuit yesterday morning on the way down here and had a very enjoyable chat with my chauffeur. So the client I'm working with here, they sent a car to pick me up from the airport. And he rather took my breath away by telling me that he loves Suzuka. And I said, so why do you're a driver here in Miami? He said, yeah, but I'm massively into esports. He said, I started racing GT cars online years ago. And he said, I just fell in love with Suzuka. So he said, I'm a Suzuka expert. He said, I would defy anyone to beat me around Suzuka, which I thought was a brave statement from someone driving an Escalade with me in the back down to Boca Raton. But it actually illustrates a really important point, which is that the interest and the enthusiasm amongst many people for Formula One coming here is just it's fantastic. So, I mean, let's hope we see a great weekend.
Extraordinary. We used to have, I won't call it a sim because it was basically an Xbox hidden under a posh racing seat in the office. And we used to occasionally get racing drivers of a particular stripe in to set hot laps, and some were more impressive than others. Guan Yu Zhou, very good. Harrison Newey, not so much. Anyhow, speaking of people who've driven racing cars in the past,
is that the best you can do?
Sorry, Connors, even I have driven racing cars in the past. I think Ben, more accurately, continues to drive racing cars.
I do still occasionally drive them, yeah. I'm not an ex-driver yet.
We do speak of a certain Lotus 49 as being the ex-Ben Anderson Lotus 49 rather than the ex-Graham Hill Lotus 49. Anyway, yeah, look, feet firmly on the ground within reach of the pedals in sunny Surrey. It is our glorious editor, Ben Anderson. Hello, Ben.
Hello. Yes, I've parked my fake super yacht in the garden and ridden my cable car up to the podcast setup here, ready to go.
Let me tell you more about the fake marina. Security is tight around the fake marina because, of course, needless to say, I'll say it anyway, some people are driven to mock the whole scene. And one chap from Sky posed for a photo pretending to swim in it and was ejected by security. So anyone else attempting a similar feat is having their accreditation examined.
We want everyone to have fun at the inaugural Miami Grand Prix, say the organisers, but not too much fun.
Well, we don't want them to dive in and find that it's actually a solid surface, not water. Although I have to say that our colleague Alex Kalinorkas from Autosport is auto sporting very long hair at the moment. So without wishing to utter a blasphemy, I was considering it possibly quite an amusing publicity stunt to have him dress up as Jesus with his long hair, maybe some sandals, and walk on water.
Yeah, I don't think it's worth it because I think the security here would probably would even take Jesus's accreditation away from him.
They don't have a sense of humor, do they?
Yeah. That's one thing. Everyone in the US security industry is a little bit quick to respond to any any incident unfolding. There was a lady going through airport security in front of me who made the huge mistake of wearing her, you know, a piece of jewellery into the body scanner machine, and she was sort of almost tackled to the ground by three fully armed security staff because she had, she had forgotten to take her big necklace off. So anyway, it was there we go.
Isn't there a visual gag in the film Airport where a little old lady walks through the scanners and is sets it off and gets tackled to the ground by umpteen security people, while in the background a group of people with, you know, carrying hand grenades and Kalashnikovs and things like that just walk straight through without it beeping?
Yeah.
That will no doubt be triggering for some people. I unfortunately didn't get the grand tour of the campus yesterday because my flight didn't arrive till 5 o'clock-ish. So my colleagues were given the grand tour during the day. When I met up with them, they were looking as sweaty and pinguid as typical Englishmen are in what I would describe as quite sultry tropical conditions here. It's hot, yeah. But you get the obligatory mid afternoon shower or late afternoon shower. It was a bit more than that. It was a thunderstorm. Also, the guided tour was given by a former colleague of ours, Ben, none other than James P.G. Roberts.
That's what he's doing in Miami. Word had
gainful
reached
employment.
Me.
Yeah, gainful employment as a tour guide. I hoped he had an umbrella to point at various things. Truly, Jimmy
was he tipped? Was he tipped for his service?
Should we give US style tips? I'm not sure about the way that the bidding is opened at 18.5% these days. I mean, I'd give him a chunk of chocolate or something, but you know, maybe a pound coin or something. Here, have buy some sweets.
Well, best wishes to Jimmy.
Yeah. Well done, Jimmy. He won't be listening to this, of course. Anyhow, let's move on. lest this prattle end up on the cutting
room floor. No, he didn't really care for audio-visual, did he?
This month's GP Racing on the newsstands today. The cover feature is a deep dive into what's gone wrong with the Mercedes W13. Probably not a very auspicious naming policy there. Big rule changes often have the effect of resetting the competitive order, but it's fair to say that very few people would have been confident predicting just how bad the situation would be with Mercedes. And we sent someone suitably rigorous to find out what's going on. Andrew Benson, the BBC's chief sports writer, cast the net wide as to why Mercedes seems to have been more afflicted than other teams by the phenomenon of porpoising. And the too long didn't read is they didn't do it on porpoise.
That's terrible.
And as the tumbleweed floats by.
Yeah, absolutely.
not even worth a tumbleweed.
I think you deserve to be tackled to the ground by four security people.
Yes. Well, the day is still young here.
The day is still young, yeah.
What was interesting for me about the feature, well, all of it was interesting, of course, otherwise we wouldn't have published it, but Andrew spoke to Frank Durney, who, you know, designed the aerodynamics on a lot of very successful Williams cars through the 1980s and spent a lot of time in Formula One and ended up at Toyota helping them to come to the cusp of actually having a competitive car before they pulled the plug. One of the matters arising from this piece is that the older generation of Formula One engineers, people who may even have already retired, the Ross Brawns, the Pat Simmons, the people who maybe no longer have hands-on engineering touch of cars nowadays, understand what porpoising is. They could have kind of expected it, and they know how to mitigate it. But the young F1 engineers who've only ever worked in F1 have never experienced it before and don't really know how to manage it.
Rather typical of Andrew to turn to some of those old hands, because he would understand that, like so many things that come up when, you know, race cars go through often quite dramatic evolutions, you discover it has actually been tried before. Something similar has happened in the past, and this is where the combination of youth and experience is so important in Formula One teams. And I think, you know, Frank Durney, as you say, a bit of a legendary designer. I was going to say legendary character, far, far deeper than that, legendary engineer and designer, is a good person to have turned to because of his work on aerodynamics and the way in which Formula One was harnessing underbody aerodynamics in its relative infancy. I'm talking about in the first 15, 20 years of underbody aerodynamics really being understood, because that's when so many issues initially came to light and then had to quickly be resolved. And I think it is also interesting to think about the fact that way back in the early to mid 1990s, you know, Williams had some of the most sophisticated Formula One cars we have ever seen. And so fast forward to today, and you have an old hand like Frank, and I'm sure he won't mind me saying an old hand like Frank. I'm rather amused by the fact that while most Formula One engineers have incredibly long biographies on LinkedIn about all their accomplishments and achievements and everything they've done and awards they've had, Frank's biography on LinkedIn is retired. which is to the point. It communicates the message pretty clearly. But it is interesting, isn't it, that despite all of the tools that are available today, all the ability to simulate car performance, to effectively create a digital version of the car before you ever go and manufacture it and see, to have a very good idea of whether things are going to work. And of course, in this era of the cost cap, you really don't want to manufacture something that doesn't work, because every dollar spent is so important. So to consider the might of the Mercedes team in Brackley, you know, first of all, decided on a particular design philosophy, some might say a high-risk philosophy, quite highly innovative, or at least trying to be highly innovative with these new regulations, and at every stage clearly signed it off in the belief that, yeah, this is the product for us to get behind, and then discover a whole series of unintended consequences emerge. And it's a lot more complex than just one thing needing fixed. You know, of the floor, major topic Toto Wolff talking about the other day, the extent to which, you know, floor design is so important. But we're talking about a lot more than that. It's vehicle dynamics, it's aerodynamics, it's the way the car behaves as it moves through the air at different velocities. You've got a whole series of complexities which mean that this is not an easy problem to solve. And I think it's been interesting, not only I think amongst commentators, of, you know, observers of the sport, young fans on social media following the sport, you know, the huge influx of fans that we've had over the years, lots of people hoping over the first two or three races Mercedes are going to turn up with a fix, and then being slightly surprised, oh, actually, this is quite complicated. Well, of course it is. It's massively complicated. And this is the thing which, you know, I think comes to light when in Andrew's piece, is he's, you know, go and talk to people who, yes, they're old hands at this, but they've all been around this block, and they know that perhaps particularly when you go through a period of domination such as Mercedes has enjoyed, the fall from grace can seem so much worse. But actually all that's happened is that having got it so right for so long, they've now got a couple of parts of the equation wrong at the moment, and unpicking that is massively difficult. So, you know, here we are in May, wondering, can Mercedes turn things around? In a month's time, the season will be a third of the season will be gone. And the speed, the relentless nature of this business means that complex problems aren't easily solvable, even with all the people that Mercedes have, because again, we're in a resource restricted environment. So it's just that little bit more difficult to do what the big teams used to do, which was to throw the kitchen sink at problems and bring out B-spec cars and all these other things which used to be commonplace. So it's really interesting, and hurrah for the older generation of engineers who still have something to give in this business of in this world of computer simulations and technology. Just one final point on that. Something that I notice in just in wider industry, wider business, and end up quite often talking to companies about, and I think it absolutely applies in Formula One, and I often mention this, is that technology for technology's sake doesn't solve problems. People need to be able to use the tools in a particular way. And if the technology enables a powerful outcome, that's great. Sometimes you can get too close to the technology and believe everything it's telling you. At the end of the day, particularly, you know, we're talking here about software-based technologies in many cases. That tool's only as good as the people who developed it and designed it. And there are still limitations within which it operates. And you know, I'll hand over to you, Ben, but having joked about the fact that you drive and you race cars, in all seriousness, I think drivers of racing cars do know one thing, which is that the theory of how something can be made fast and competitive and the reality is very often a different thing. And it's getting that lined up that becomes, I mean, that's the art of successful teams. It's building a car that then does exactly what it says on the racetrack, and the Mercedes W13 doesn't. And unfortunately, it's probably not taken too many laps by Lewis Hamilton and George Russell for them to come back and say, you know, Houston, we've got a problem.
Well, yeah, absolutely. I mean, the car's so bad, it's actually shaking them to bits, isn't it? I think George was quoted after the previous race at Imola saying he was starting to feel pain in his chest and back from all the bouncing. And Mercedes just seem a bit trapped. I mean, the gap between the theory and the reality, I think, is quite key here. And we've talked many times over the years, especially when the rules change, about correlation of the wind tunnel data and the on-track testing. And teams regularly fall into this trap. It happened to Ferrari a lot until recently. It happened to Red Bull when the rules changed massively for 2017 and the cars got much bigger. It took them a while to, it took about five races to get on top of that, but they were much less competitive than they thought they would be, Renault aside, for that part of that season. And it feels like Mercedes have fallen into a similar kind of trap, but just in a much bigger and more significant way. You can catastrophize it or say, oh, well, they've only slipped from maybe joint first after last year with Red Bull to third, but it's the gap from third to second and first that's the really alarming thing. You know, they're more, certainly over one lap, they're more of a midfield team now than they are a front-running team. In the race, it's better. It seems that, you know, fundamentally, there's a bit more performance there that they can unlock when the car's heavier and you're not having to push flat out. But when they try to dial it up, they can't get the tyres working properly. The drivers can't see when they're approaching the corners. They're getting shaken around. The engine's not working properly because the bouncing's so severe. And suddenly you start to see this massive gap between what, you know, the controlled environments of computer simulation and the wind tunnel are saying is a really, really fast car and what the reality is, which is a car that's near as damn it a second off the pace, I think, maybe a bit less, depending on where you go. And there's nothing the drivers can do about that. You know, that's when you're getting into a situation where, you know, Formula One is more about the car than the driver. You know, the driver can be as fantastic as Lewis Hamilton is, and he hasn't forgotten how to drive over the first four races, but there's just a limit to what he can do with the car as it is. George Russell seems to be faring a bit better. He's had a bit more luck in some races, I would say, but also he's coming from a lower bar. And you've seen it in the past when Daniel Ricciardo stepped up to Red Bull and they went from multi-champion team to relative disaster zone in 2014. He had a much stronger season than Sebastian Vettel. Much was made of the come down of, you know, Vettel not being able to compete for a championship again. And to some extent that was true. And there was some other stuff around the braking systems changing that made him a bit more uncomfortable perhaps for a while. But a lot of it was down to Ricciardo's reference just being that much lower. So even the relatively disastrous 2014 Red Bull was a step up for him compared to a Toro Rosso. But for Vettel, it was a huge drop back in terms of performance and grip and everything else. And he found that adjustment difficult, probably seeing a slightly similar version of that between Russell and Hamilton from the driver's point of view. But the other thing is, I don't see necessarily Mercedes fixing this problem this year. They seem at the moment a bit paralyzed. The cost cap is one element that's obviously stopping them from just, as you say, flinging bits at the car and just trying to hope it gets better. They have to properly unpick all their work to decide what's actually going to fix it before they can build it, which is why it seems that updates are being delayed race after race, even coming to this weekend. You know, there was supposed to be a new wing in Australia that was delayed, and then coming into Miami, they're talking about, well, actually, we've got some experiments to do. So they don't really understand yet why their car doesn't work. I mean, Dernie makes the point in Andrew's feature about the floor, and maybe it will always leak. And obviously, they're trying to create these sort of virtual seals underneath. You can't have actual skirts anymore, and it will always leak. And he would basically be hacking bits out of the floor to try and see what works and what doesn't. So maybe that's what they'll be doing. I also find it interesting that the ground effect, even though it seems like it's not been around for 40 years, and that's why, you know, suddenly, I mean, maybe they should hire Durney, as he's one of the guys still around who does understand it. I mean, you've got Ferrari with Rory Byrne as a consultant. He was around back then. They're competitive. Adrian Newey, obviously, Red Bull are competitive. So it's obviously a good thing to have somebody, an old hand who understands the phenomenon. Maybe it's a coincidence, but it doesn't seem likely.
I have to keep an eye out on LinkedIn in case Frank Durney changes his profile.
Yeah, exactly.
Unretired.
Unretired, lucratively unretired. But of course, you know, Red Bull have been employing ground effect on the front wing of the car by running, you know, the high rake, as it was known, design. And Mercedes always shied away from that and ran a much flatter car. And when the rules were introduced, you kind of thought, oh, okay, so the cars are not going to be running that kind of attitude anymore. So that would play into Mercedes' favour. But actually, maybe it's hurt them in the sense that they haven't got that much experience within the current setup of running parts of the car in that way. And they haven't then been able to use that to inform the rest of the car so well. But as you say, Mark, there's so many other things going on as well. You've added the cost cap, which restricts their opportunity. There's a certain people element involved, I think, although Toto Wolff likes to play it down, as he would do, because obviously he wants to have faith in his organisational structure. But, you know, they've lost the main architect of their engine programme that's been so successful. And obviously James Allison has moved upstairs, and he was very much the head honcho technically. So, you know, even if some of those people are still around, you've had some internal change and people in new jobs, and that's always going to cause some disruption. You've got an area of specialism here where perhaps engineers haven't got the breadth of experience of doing other categories. This phenomenon of the bouncing or the porpoising is known in Le Mans prototype sports cars. But of course, if you've only worked in Formula One and on Formula One cars, you won't necessarily have either the contacts or the experience of that and how to dial it out. And the final thing I find really fascinating is that this phenomenon is not unique to Mercedes. Pretty much every team has suffered, some extremely badly at the start of testing. Alfa Romeo were one. Ferrari, who've been pretty much setting the pace, you can see their cars doing it, but other teams have found a way to manage it. They all obviously want to get rid of it at some point, but they found a way to manage it more successfully. So that surely has to relate to the new tyres and the stiffness of those tyres, which are bigger now and have higher sidewalls, and the suspension, how that all interacts with the aerodynamics. Mercedes is clearly missing something quite significant. And it seems to me at the moment, they actually don't know what that is. They're stuck trying to work out what things have we got wrong and how on earth do we go about fixing it. It's not as simple as just going, oh, we need to copy that guy's front wing, or, oh, we need to copy that car's diffuser. It's much, much more complicated than that. So it'd be really, really interesting to see how things progress over the rest of the year. But it might take a number of seasons. Maybe next season is the earliest that they start to really make inroads into that, because they might have to change the concept entirely, and you can't really do that, especially under a cost cap, in a matter of a few races.
It's quite significant, isn't it, that they're spending a lot of their racing weekends looking for trackside engineering solutions and doing these experiments, as they call them, really to see what levers they can pull, doing stuff like ride heights, even tyre pressures they've been investigating. So they're trying to build up that sort of fundamental knowledge of how the car behaves so that they can then feed into their virtual testing program, because I mean, it really does look evil, doesn't it? That bump on the main straight at Imola, just as it bends to the left. We've got one of the parades this month, a lovely picture of Mick Schumacher from above, taken by Stephen T, if memory serves, and he observed that all the cars were going over this bump and setting up a nice shower of sparks, but the Mercedes just looked like a bucking Bronco when it went over there. I'm glad I enunciated that phrase properly at this time in the morning. It just looked horrendous, and they seem no closer to sorting out. And
are you not caffeinated yet, Codders? Is that why you're... wondering about your doubting yourself, shall we say.
There are no supermarkets near here, and the nearest coffee shop is at least a mile and a half away. So one would have to summon a taxi or take a 40-minute walk.
You need Mark's chauffeur. That's what you need.
No, he needs my Nespresso machine, which I have in my room. So.
Damn you.
Other brands of coffee machine are available.
Recyclable capsules, I hope, now.
Moving on from my woes, another big name struggling at the moment is Aston Martin. Not actually a new team. In a previous incarnation, it was an organisation that was at the head of the midfield as recently as two seasons ago. And it was an organisation with a reputation for delivering more bang per buck than any other, certainly amongst its peers. So does this prove once again that adding resources doesn't necessarily make a team more competitive? Is it a case of specialisms? Is it a case of people not having the depth of experience necessarily to tackle a new regime? We'll see. But this month, Mark compared Aston Martin with one of the last big name manufacturers to get involved in F1 by buying another team, and that was Jaguar. And that didn't end well. I mean, I think without doing any spoilers.
Statement.
I suppose it did end well because they're now Red Bull, but it took a little bit of shaking about.
On that very point, one of the people I spoke to at Aston Martin said it might not be all that bad because he said maybe we will end up being bought by someone who turns us into 4 times world champions. So it's kind of which wasn't really.
Is that what Audi are going to do?
Which wasn't really the strategy I was expecting to hear. But I mean, for those of you who kind of might be wondering why on earth we chose the parallel with Jaguar Racing, of course, aside from the fact that it's kind of racing green, British sports car brand, seeking to become Britain's answer to Ferrari. All those good things were said about Jaguar back in the day. a large company, a large shareholder, in the case of Jaguar, it was Ford Motor Company, buying a small independent team which had been quite successful, Stewart Grand Prix. And in the case of Aston Martin F1, of course, buying what was Racing Point and back in the day, Jordan Grand Prix and Spyker and Midland, but a team which has in its past won some Grand Prix and has acquitted itself extremely well, including in recent times, as you say, Cotter's, as Racing Point. And, you know, Force India had some good showings during, you know, before the financial limitations of their shareholders became all too evident. So there's a number of parallels between the Jaguar and Aston Martin story, which have been drawn. Also the fact that when those big shareholders bought those small independent teams, they thought, oh, we'll go and recruit a driver from Ferrari. And Jaguar brought in Eddie Irvine. Eddie Irvine, who, if I look out the window of the hotel, owns an island about 1 hour's private plane flight from here. So he lives
there
in...
There you go. That's a big middle finger to the Ford executives who didn't know who he was.
Yeah. Is it true that none other than Henry Ford Jr. or whatever was looking down the payroll and said, who the hell is Ed Irvine?
When Ford Motor Company were going through, I mean, they were having a massive financial crisis. There was a huge pension fund issue. It was just the brands were floundering. People may not remember, or listening to the podcast, maybe too young to remember, but to know this. But if you go back 20 years ago, Ford Motor Company owned Jaguar Land Rover. They owned Volvo. They owned Aston Martin. Ironically, they owned the Aston Martin company. They owned Cosworth. So there was a premier automotive group, which included Aston and Jaguar and Cosworth. And in doing this feature, I decided to speak to Tony Purnell, who was the team principal at Jaguar Racing in its final couple of years, and actually was the early team principal of Red Bull Racing before Christian Horner's appointment. And Tony's a great guy. You know, he's an incredibly talented individual. He works at Cambridge University these days, works on British cycling programs. He's a passionate cyclist, and all in all, a very bright guy and a very, very clever a very, very clever man. His name may not be familiar to, again, many of the listeners, but if you've ever heard of PI, which was Purnell Instrumentation, they basically developed race car telemetry. So the PI group became kind of the ubiquitous supplier of telemetry to race cars through the late 80s through the 1990s, and was then acquired.
I've seen many a data trace from that system not quite former racing days.
You've driven a few racing cars. And also, as you say, Mark, he sold it, so presumably he knows the value of Pi. Anyhow, carry on.
He does. And in his case, Pi had a lot of zeros at the end of it when he sold it to Ford Motor Company. He didn't have to remember lots of complicated numbers. But, yeah, he sold the company to Ford, and that company continues today as Cosworth Electronics, still in Cambridge, where he founded it. And it was interesting talking to Tony because, first of all, he gave me a lot of time. And although there's a veneer of parallel between Jaguar and Aston Martin, actually, when you dig below the surface, there were a lot of differences. And you mentioned the fact that Bill Ford Jr. didn't know who Eddie Irvine was. It's a true story. Tony confirmed it. He wasn't in the particular meeting where that came up, but he was able to vouch for the fact that because Ford were going through so many financial difficulties, they decided to have a look at all of the top salaries across the whole business. And in the top 10 salaries in the whole of Ford was this. In fact, I think it was like the second or third salary in the whole company was E. Irvine, and Bill Ford wanted to know what does he do? Is he running a car business for us, or is he chief technical officer or something? No, he's our Formula One driver. So
he's anyway, investing in islands.
Yeah, but here's the thing that became very evident. First of all, there's a big difference between Jaguar and Aston Martin. In Formula One, because Jaguar had an owner who did not understand the sport and wasn't really that committed to it. And Tony makes the point that in relative terms, relative to the size of Ford Motor Company, buying Jaguar and running Jaguar was small fry. It just didn't really get on the radar. It was actually a relatively easy purchase for the then boss of Ford Motor Company, Jack Nasser, to make to buy Stewart Grand Prix. I'm not going to say they thought it would be easy, but they certainly underestimated the complexity of it. It descended very quickly into just a catalogue of mismanagement with lots of different leaders being brought in to try and run the business. I mean, incredibly, the Formula One team was parked under Wolfgang Reitzle, the boss of Premier Automotive Group. And I remember meeting him in the first season of Jaguar Racing. To me, he didn't come across well. Tony was saying to me what a great guy Wolfgang was, but whatever he was good at in the car industry, he certainly underestimated the complexity of Formula One. Neil Ressler, who was brought in from Ford to run it, he really didn't understand the sport, didn't get on top of it. They then kind of thrashed around trying to find experts that they could plug in. So they went and they got Bobby Rahal because he was a big name in America, so he understood car racing. Well, the problem is Bobby Rahal had never run a Formula One team, and they then made this rather strange decision to bring in Niki Lauda because they brought in Niki at a time when Bobby was there. And of course, they were never going to hit it off. Very, very different personalities.
They tried to sign Newey as well, didn't they?
Bobby Rahal tried to get Newey, didn't he?
So there were lots of quick fixes. They tried, let's go and employ someone who can just sort this all out. And of course, one of the points that Tony talked to me about in the feature is you need a long-term plan. And when Ford turned to Tony and said, look, you've run a company in racing, would you come and run Jaguar Racing? He went in and he ran starting in 2003 along with Dave Pitchforth. And again, the team finished seventh in the Constructors' Championship. And at the end of that first year, after 1 year, Tony was told, right, that's it, we're sort of going to pack it in and sell the team. And he talked about a rather pivotal meeting where he sat in Detroit in a board meeting with all the top brass. He described it as actually a really good meeting. People were really engaged. How do we sort this out? And in that meeting, he told them something they didn't really want to hear, which is that it'll take 5 years. you need to look at the budget of Ferrari and be prepared to step up. You've got to invest seriously. And if you do that, and if you employ the right people and put the right structure in place, in 5 years' time, you might be in a position to win. And he feels that accelerated their decision to leave. They just didn't have the appetite to do that. Now, we then jump over to Aston Martin. So the first difference is that while Bill Ford didn't understand who Eddie Irvine was and the board of Ford Motor Company wasn't really understanding Formula One, at least in the case of Lawrence Stroll, you have someone who has literally lived his life passionate with racing. He's himself has been a racing driver. He's
He's driven a few race cars. Like Ben, he's driven a few race cars in his time.
He certainly has driven a few race cars. And
he's driven more Ferraris than me, I think.
He's got a huge collection. And, I mean, he does understand racing. He's massively personally committed to the Formula One project and financially committed with his shareholders to the whole Aston Martin project, both the car company and the Formula One team. And, of course, he's invested on many levels, including, you know, with his son Lance, providing the resource necessary for Lance to come up through the ranks and get to Formula One and stay there. So one big difference is a degree of commitment from the effectively, in this case, the person who owns the team is really, really determined to make it work. Another big difference is that, you know, the team is actually well sponsored at the moment. So Jaguar Racing always struggled with sponsorship. Now, people, again, who are old enough will remember the team was sponsored by HSBC and there were a few other brands on the car. I joined the team, actually, just at the point where Tony brought me in to help him sell the team, and I then stayed under Red Bull, working with Christian initially. The thing that was striking was when you looked at the sponsorship portfolio, you realised that actually there was a Ford element to most of the deals. So even the HSBC deal had a Ford link because the boss of HSBC was on the board of Ford Motor Company. So it was a little bit of a boys' network deal. And there are a few other sponsors on the car who actually, when you looked, it was Lear Corporation was one. And the Lear Corporation, it turns out, makes seats for Ford Motor Company's cars. So, of course, they have this massive, massive contract. So kind of sweetener was a little bit of sponsorship for the F1 team. The difference with Aston Martin is they've got this incredible lineup of commercial sponsors, crypto.com, Cognizant. I met the chief executive of Cognizant, the Australian Grand Prix. They are massively committed to Formula One with Aston Martin. They've got, you know, Peroni, Azzurro, the very famous Italian beer brand. Actually, the commercial team at Aston Martin have done a fantastic job, really, really good job. Now, why is that important? It's important because if the team commercially is working, that takes the pressure off the shareholders of having to put in more money and especially with the budget cap as well. So the pain factor financially isn't quite the same for Aston Martin as it was for Jaguar Racing. And, of course, we're also working in an era where the prize money and the way in which the revenue is shared in Formula One is so much better. So Aston Martin getting a decent chunk of money at each year from the prize money, irrespective of where they finish in the World Championship. So the commercial model, very different. The level of commitment at the top, very, very different. The problems of competitiveness clearly are there at the moment. Jaguar never dug themselves out of the hole. You would say that Aston Martin F1 have a better chance of doing that because they have a lot of talent in the team. But you raise an important point, Cotters, which is that you have this small, independent sort of challenger team, a kind of a midfield team punching above its weight. And you then resource upwards. You know, you're building a new factory. The new factory was a topic that I ended up talking to them about. It's really interesting to hear people within Aston say to me, well, look, you know, the factory really isn't going to be on stream for another year, 2023. 2024 will be the first car to be produced, you know, fully in that factory. And inevitably, there will be teething problems with the factory. So actually, 2025 will probably be the first proper car, you know, well conceived with a factory that's fully operational. And that's 3 years down the road. So there is an acknowledgement that, just as we talked about Mercedes-Benz, the fixes to become competitive are not going to be overnight. So Sebastian Vettel's not going to suddenly turn up with a car mid-season this year that enables him to qualify on the second row of the grid and start going for podiums. It's just not going to happen. So they're on a long trajectory, and all again to a point you just made, Cotters, the other fact is we've got a couple of major car manufacturers about to come into Formula One with the news that Volkswagen Audi Group have made the commitment to bring Audi and Porsche into the sport, and that's going to happen in 2026. So what does that mean for Aston Martin? Well, it means that if Aston Martin are not fully competitive by 2026, they may well find themselves up against two giants of the automotive industry, both of whom know motor racing extremely well and tend to do things well. So that injects another sense of urgency. So actually, going back to a point I made at the beginning of this long answer, the fact that someone said to me, well, maybe our future is in other hands. Maybe the future for Aston Martin and Formula One is that we become competitive under new owners in the future. May not be so wrong, because we know that Porsche are planning to partner with Red Bull Racing, possibly on an equity basis as well, acquiring part of the team. Audi, it looks like they want to actually take over a team. And they've made overtures to McLaren, which so far have not been successful. So maybe Aston Martin is another option. So there's lots of intriguing possibilities. My own view is that Lawrence Stroll will do everything he can to make Aston Martin the car company and the Formula One team independently successful over the next 3 to 5 years. However, he's an astute businessman. If an opportunity comes over the horizon, that means that he can get all the money back and make a profit and secure the future of the business, et cetera, et cetera, he may well look at doing it. And the final kind of thing I'll say, which is not in the feature, but has happened since the feature was written, is that the chief executive of Aston Martin car company, Tobias Moers, is being let go. And that announcement was made just before we recorded this podcast this week. And he has been in his position for 21 months. That's an incredibly short time. And again, it suggests that there's something not quite working with the planning that and the structure that Lawrence is putting in place, because Tobias Moers was headhunted from AMG. He was running the AMG part of Mercedes car company. And his arrival was big news. And he had a massive clear out when he joined the company. A lot of, by all accounts, very talented people left the business, people who were very well known to automotive journalists. And that's something that I'd been noticing over the last 18 months. So he cleared out a lot of people who had been at Aston Martin for a while. He understood perhaps a lot about the company and the brand. He also, interestingly, cancelled their electric vehicle program, which had been started by the previous chief executive. So what does this all tell us? It tells us that 21 months ago, Lawrence Stroll and his shareholders thought that Tobias Moers was the right man to turn the Aston Martin car company around. That's not worked out. And it's not worked out in actually quite a short period of time. And again, there's major change. And the major change is seeing him turning to people who he knows from Ferrari, bringing in a lot of people from Ferrari to run the car business to try and turn it around. Now, I'll finish now, but that's perhaps the one worrying point that comes out of doing this feature, is that there's a veneer of similarity between Aston Martin and Jaguar, which doesn't really stand scrutiny. Below the surface, there's a lot of differences. However, one concern has to be that the fact that Lawrence does know something about racing might be a dangerous thing. He might, a little bit of knowledge might be a dangerous thing. He must surely not be looking for quick fixes. No matter what the pressure is, he's got to take that time. Took Red Bull 5 years to turn Jaguar Racing into the dominant team it became, really second half of 2009 and then winning the championship in 2010. 5 years, again, feels like a sensible time. And again, going back to the factory conversation, even people within Aston Martin are saying it could take that length of time before they become competitive. So it is how patient is Lawrence to allow his existing management structure to become cohesive, to get the strategy, to get aligned behind it, to develop that, drive it forward. Is he going to be patient, or are we going to start seeing chopping and changing? And if we start to see chopping and changing, that's going to be bad news, because one thing we know is that teams only ever eventually get to where they need to when you have a period of stability and rebuilding and getting rid of blame culture and all that kind of stuff. Look at Ferrari. You know, Ferrari accepted a couple of years in the doldrums before they came back with what we've got this year. So there's a little bit of a question mark about the degree of Lawrence's patience while they go through what is still a building phase, a rebuilding phase for this team.
There's probably two things that add to his impatience as well that I wonder about. And the first is that this isn't year two of five, is it? This is a project that really began when he acquired Force India and turned it into Racing Point. And then they had a couple of quite successful, a season and a half of relative success, particularly 2020 with the Pink Mercedes, as it was known. You've got the added challenge of a dip in terms of performance under the same ownership while he's trying to inject resource to actually go the opposite direction and go forward. So they've gone backwards in year one of Aston Martin, but not year one of the project for Lawrence. So that's got to rankle with him. And then also, when you bring in this potential for Audi to acquire a team, which they're pretty much going to have to do if they want to be a works outfit, I doubt they're going to be granted an 11th entry. This whole Concorde agreement with the franchise value, they're either going to have to pay a shed load of money to get in and build up from scratch. It makes a lot more sense to just acquire some infrastructure. It's surely cheaper overall. He's got to make that decision before 2025, because he's not going to be able to sell his team in 2025 ready for Audi to come in theory in 2026. So the two plans don't mesh, and that, you know, if Aston are prepared to talk to you about the possible out already, that is a valid option. They'd have to take that decision earlier than the 5 years that's been set out. So stick or twist, what do you do? Yeah. I guess it depends on his appetite, but I don't imagine he'll be very happy to keep digging in if results don't improve relatively quickly. It's the age-old pressure, isn't it? You're right, as you said in the feature and repeated here, and McLaren have done this now since the Honda thing ended. It's about having a long-term plan, looking at every big thing and trying to improve it before you worry too much about going for the championship and setting big goals. But at the same time, you do need to get results in the here and now. Otherwise, everything you do is affected, because your championship result dictates a big portion of how much money comes in. And you kind of need to see this progression, or at least be able to justify why you've stood still maybe in a season. Renault have just about been able to get away with this. They kind of stagnated a bit, and then they've rebranded, and there's a sort of a bit of excitement with the rules changing. Maybe they'll get there. McLaren, they cleaned house, but actually they were so disastrous with Honda that the only way was up, and they have got better. You can rebuild confidence even if there's still a long way to go in the overall plan. When you add the dip that Aston's had since becoming Aston out of Racing Point, and then all these other time pressures ahead down the road, it feels like a difficult thing to predict. And obviously they've still got lots of people to come in that they've hired that haven't started yet, or haven't had a chance to have a material impact. So you want to see what the likes of Dan Fallows can do, and the other people that they've hired in to bolster the technical team. How long will that take to mesh? Obviously they won't have the new resources to work with yet, because the factory's still to open. The wind tunnel won't come on stream in time. But if they can complete all of that capital investment and get it up and running properly in time for, at least tell Audi they can get it up and running in time for 2026, maybe that is the best decision Stroll can make. As you said, he's an astute businessman. Yeah. So he's bought a team at rock bottom, built it up, rebranded it, put in some capital investment to sort out the infrastructure, he could sell it on for a tidy profit perhaps. And
yeah,
that would be a very good result for him, I would have thought, as a businessman. When so many people, as you, I think you mentioned this in your feature, I think Bernie Eccleston told executives of Jaguar Racing that, you know, there's always another billionaire ready to come in and lose money in Formula One. So I'm sure Stroll would like the idea of changing that narrative.
Yeah, that was a lovely story that Tony Purnell told me about, you know, Bernie Eccleston saying, look, Tony, the way to think, this is the way it works, you know, it's don't worry about it, it's all fine. You know, there's always a billionaire around the corner waiting to buy a Formula One team, so it'll all be fine, you know. And sure enough, there was one called Dietrich Mateschitz who came along, bought Jaguar and turned it into Red Bull Racing. So just a couple of points and then hand back to you, Connors. Just picking up on what you said, Ben, so it's really interesting what you say. I don't include the Racing Point years in the Stroll plan because, and the reason I don't is that, and I've used this analogy before in a GP Racing feature, buying that team is like buying a corner shop, and he's now decided to turn it into Tesco's. And the first year and a half he was running it, it was still a corner shop, and it was a really good little corner shop, and it was still punching above its weight. The difficulty is that now they're building the massive Tesco superstore and planning to move the corner shop into that, and they're resourcing accordingly and bringing in people and leadership teams and all the rest of it. And suddenly it's a company in transition, massive transition, going from small to large, going from you know, still the kind of vestiges of a kind of family team, which it was under Jordan for 15 years, to this, you know, the Goliath that Lawrence wants it to become. And I think there's a number of interesting things that I feel are happening in Formula One these days. And when you look at Mike Crack, who was brought in as team principal, and then Martin Whitmarsh, who effectively Mike reports to. I mean, one of the interesting things is the extent to which the two of them are able to form a strong partnership to sometimes withstand the pressure from Lawrence Stroll to say, listen, Lawrence, we need to take more time over this. Because if that doesn't happen, you have the team principals now who are employees. They no longer own the teams that they run, with the exception of Toto Wolff. You have the potential that if things don't work within a year or two, you know, Mike Crack finds himself replaced because, well, Lawrence is going to find someone else who can do it in the way that he's done in the Aston Martin car company with Tobias Moores. And, I mean, some of you may be aware, Gerhard Berger has been incredibly critical of Mike Crack. Didn't feel Mike Crack was an A-lister to run, to be team principal, and made some really quite outspoken comments about Mike Crack and said, you know, is this a boy being asked to do a man's job? Now, that there may be reasons why Gerhard Berger is being so critical of Mike. There may be some baggage in their relationship, which, you know, we don't know about. But it's interesting to consider that with a shareholder as strong as Lawrence Stroll, who appears to want to be involved in key decisions and managing how these programs run, you know, does it suit him to employ a weaker team principal, someone who frankly does the paperwork and sort of runs the minutiae of the business, while Lawrence and perhaps Martin Whitmarsh are looking after the bigger picture? So these become really important things to watch out for. And you see it elsewhere in Formula One at the moment, for example, with Otmar Szafnauer at Alpine, and yet Laurent Rossi, he's the chief executive of Alpine Cars, is heavily involved in the Formula One program, to the extent that in Imola, when they had the team, you know, principal dinner, you have a couple of teams turn up with two bosses. So, you know, you end up seeing Laurent Rossi and Otmar Szafnauer there. Then you end up seeing Zach Brown and Andreas Seidel there. And I was looking at that photograph thinking,
and Mike Crack didn't get to go, did he?
Because has anyone seen Mike Crack?
He said there was a communication malfunction or something that many couldn't go. And I considered this is why Szafnauer left Aston and went to Alpine, so he could get invited to the team principals dinner. Do you want to miss out on the social event of the year? And if he'd stayed where he was, he wouldn't have been there.
But it raises an interesting point, which is that, you know, do we now have teams where there's a slight lack of clarity about who the boss is? there needs to be a boss. And again, going back to, you know, back to the Eccleston era, which at the end of the day only finished 5 years ago, if a team principal's dinner had been called, as they often were, if two people had turned up, Bernie would have just said, one of you is leader. I mean, it would have been incredibly binary. So it's really interesting to see how the new employee team principal is perhaps not as in a strong position as they used to be, and the pressure on them is perhaps even more intense. Because this, you know, the sport's going through this surging growth phase. So it's really interesting to look at all of the dynamics around this. So I'm sure, you know, it'll be interesting. You know, I'd love to.
There's a celebrity element to it too, as well, isn't there? Because there was talk of having like a team principal's parade at the Miami Grand Prix, which I think Toto Wolff
was asked about. Is that now going to happen?
And then he said it was his understanding that it had been cancelled and he was thankful for that. But you could imagine, you know, in the Netflix era where, you know, stars are being made out of more people in F1 than perhaps was the case in the recent past. Even drivers who previously would have been considered kind of midfield fodder and not really worth talking about now have like much bigger followings because they've appeared on Netflix and people understand their backstory and, you know, millions of people have watched
that.
I can imagine that rubbing off on certain executives who are involved in companies running Formula One teams, and they fancy being, you know, not exactly front and center week in, week out, but, you know, having a bit of airtime. It's good for the profile, and it's not going to help this situation of clarity, I wouldn't have thought, because suddenly Formula One is a cool, attractive place to be, isn't it, for everybody? And that's good. That includes bosses.
Well, do you know, there were a lot of people on my flight who were there for the Grand Prix. There were some people there to work, I think some there to spectate, and the guy in the seat next to me basically box setted the entire latest season of Drive to Survive on his phone during the flight. If he'd chosen something with a larger screen, he could have propped it on his tray table and not had his elbow in my airspace quite as much as he did. But at least, unlike the denizen of the aisle seat opposite, he didn't keep shoving his backside in my face. But anyhow, that's just tales from economy for you. The interesting thing for me that seems to have come from matters arising in yesterday's guided tour that I was unable to participate in was that this is very targeted at wealthy people coming in. You know, obviously the residents of Miami Gardens, where I'm sitting, NFI, but it does seem the ticket prices are quite high and they're selling. And I understand that there is a lot of corporate hospitality and it is all sold out. So this is very much a Monaco style Grand Prix in Miami.
With the yachts and the marina.
Yeah, just
real
painted
or otherwise.
Well, my favorite quote that I heard yesterday was that Monaco has a real marina and fake racing, whereas Miami has a fake marina and hopefully real racing. So it's going to be interesting to see which way it goes.
We will see, and you know, looking forward to it. So
I just hope you both don't get lost in the campus, and I manage to see you again on the other side because I saw the virtual guided tour, and it looked quite sprawling.
I have to confess, I don't actually know where to pick up my pass from. So that after we've said goodbye to the listeners, sundry other jobs need to happen, like shower, clean teeth, get dressed, find some comestibles to eat and some coffee, and at some point find out where to actually pick up that pass. Or you could be
rugby tackled by security attendants and on the first flight home, which would be failed.
Don't you know who I am? Yeah, I think it is very much time for us to say goodbye, because Mark, you've got your first lucrative meeting of the day to go to as you fly in on your private jet. I've got shower.
As you're driven in by the Suzuka expert. You should time him, Mark. You should time him.
I had a taxi driver in New York on Tuesday when I arrived there, who asked me what I did, and I said I work in auto racing. I was being very American. And he said, "Oh," he said, "what type of?" And I said, "Well, I said, have you heard of Formula One? And he looked in his mirror and he said, oh, yeah, I follow that really closely. He said, do you think Leclerc can do it for Ferrari this year? But he then went on to say, and he got into it because of Netflix. So the two drivers that I've had since I got to America have both been into racing. And I have to say, I feel like that is a change. And
this is a subject of Ben Edwards' column this month, right. Actually.
Right.
He spoke to Sean Kelly at Virtual Statman on Twitter.
Oh, yeah.
Who's been in the States for a long time when F1 wasn't cool. And this story is about how, you know, this surge in interest is real. You know, his local gym, for example, you know, he's having conversations with people who he's known for a long time who are now buying tickets to the Spanish Grand Prix because they're desperate to go and see Carlos Sainz race. And, you know, it's unheard of, but the explosion in interest is massive.
Yeah. Yeah, it's terrific. And again, you know, it's interesting then to see the chief executive of Volkswagen Audi Group saying that, you know, with the surge of interest in Formula One and the way in which the sport has evolved.
Got to do it.
You got to do it. I mean, I think the phrase that he used was he said, in our board meetings, it became increasingly difficult not to want to do it, not to agree to doing it. You know, it's become a no-brainer for them to come in. So,
It's too compelling a case now. The growth of Formula One, the predicted growth, the money coming in, the profile you get, they've run out of reasons to say no, haven't they? So they're like, well, no, Porsche.
Although they haven't yet signed on the dotted line yet, have they, in order to sort of retain a bit of a negotiating hand to get the engine deal they want.
But they're going to do it, aren't they? Because, you know, the money is there to be made. They reckon Porsche can do much better business by being front and centre with Red Bull and Audi apparently have a target to compete with Mercedes in terms of price point and sales volumes for their range of cars. So they want to get in there to show that they can do Formula One better than Toto Wolff can.
Exciting times to come. And we will leave our listeners with that image in their minds. And perhaps the final image will be of a Cadillac Escalade being driven at absolute maximum velocity through the S's at Suzuka, all tyres squealing, perhaps lifting the inside rear wheel as he gives it a dab of brakes into the third one. Thank you, Ben Anderson. You may now carry on editing the magazine for the rest of the afternoon. For me and for Mark Gallagher, the day is still young. So good luck. Thank you very much, Mark, for your contribution. We'll gather again next month. The next edition of GP Racing will be on the newsstands on Thursday, June 2nd. Thank you for listening.